viewfinder. The edge of a single-story cinder block building was visible a couple hundred feet down the road. There were no lights there. A single thick chain spanned the road 50 feet ahead, secured to 2 steel posts. A metal, no trespassing sign hung down at its lowest point. Greg looked at the GPS unit. He was still 1 decimal off. He put the car in gear and, with some trepidation, let it roll forward without putting his foot on the gas. He scanned from side to side, looking for anything that wasn't a plant or a rock. He finally reached the chain and put the car in park again. He glanced at the GPS unit. He was on station. Greg hesitated for a moment, then turned off the engine. Suddenly, he could hear the woods. He heard the clattering of naked tree branches in the wind. Leaves scraped across the gravel road with each gust. The interior of the car cooled rapidly. Greg pulled the Glock 9mm pistol out of his rucksack and then freed the pistol from its holster. He placed it on the bench seat beside him. What the fuck am I doing out here? It was starting to seem like a really bad idea. He was running blind, and that was definitely something Brian Gregg did not like. It ran against his nature. He scanned the trees and the desolate-looking cinderblock building again. How did this place have anything to do with the Monte Cassino map? There wasn't even any light out here. Was there even electricity? Greg craned his neck to look up through the windshield and accidentally bumped the single night vision lens against the glass. He straightened the goggles and looked again. An electrical feed line ran along the road on the left side. Narrow utility poles of gray, cracked wood supported it every 100 feet or so. Following the line with his eyes, Greg noticed something interesting ahead. A fairly tall antenna was bolted to the side of the cinderblock building. He could see the mast rising above the roof. Greg took a deep breath. He was jittery. Time to concentrate. He pulled his laptop bag from the back seat and cleared space on the seat beside him. He put the pistol on the dashboard, then unzipped the laptop bag. He unpacked his laptop and booted up, flipping up the tiny antenna on the wireless card. He was temporarily blinded as the screen lit up, and he hurriedly stripped off the night vision goggles. While the laptop booted up, he kept looking around in the darkness. He could actually see pretty well once his eyes adjusted. There was some moonlight. After what seemed an eternity, the logon dialog came up, and a minute later, Greg launched NetStumbler. The program scanned for access points. In a moment, he was surprised to see a familiar SSID appear. Monte_Casino. The signal appeared to originate from the cinderblock building. Greg's jitters returned. Had he really done this? He tried to calm his rising fear. What was he doing? He thought about it. There was an OTR server here. He configured his Wi-Fi card to use the SSID, and soon Greg obtained an IP address on the unsecured network. He didn't even bother to explore. Instead, he closed NetStumbler and ripped open his CD case. He flipped through the CDRs until he found one marked with felt pen, OTR. He slid the CD into the laptop's drive and launched Over the Rhine. He clicked quickly past the opening screens, then selected multiplayer mode. He let the game scan for available servers. Only one appeared in the server list. Houston Monte Cassino server. This was the one visible to his wireless card. Greg smiled, then double-clicked on the name. The map started to load. Oddly, the weapon selection dialog box never appeared. Soon, Greg's avatar was standing unarmed in a trench at the base of the Monte Cassino mountain. Normally, he'd work his way around to the left, but without weapons, it was rather pointless. Greg peered over the lip of the trench, and he could see the familiar German MG-42 nests up at the edge of the ruins. Strangely, the Krauts didn't open fire immediately. Greg let his avatar stand there for a moment, and still, no tracer bullets came streaming down. He decided to push his luck and hopped up on the fire step, then out into full view. Still, no gunfire. The Germans just sat there. Greg started walking toward their lines. He had never approached the monastery successfully from this angle, and now he could see three machine gun nests aiming down at him from 100 meters away. The gun barrels followed him as he walked, but still they did not fire. Greg kept walking straight up to the center machine gun. The loader crouched next to the gunner. The NPCs had that familiar blank look on their faces. Before long, Greg was within 10 feet of the machine gun barrel. It stared down on him, ready to send his avatar into the spectator list. He was so close, he could see the rank of the gunner from the textured graphic patches on his shoulders. Unterfeldwebel, a sergeant. To Greg's shock, the gunner released his grip on the weapon and held up his hand.
Halt!
He peered at Greg closely.
Ich kenne deinen Namen!
He rose and motioned for Greg to follow.
Komm mit!
With that, the gunner walked off into the ruins. Greg hurried to follow. A dozen German soldiers rose from their concealed positions among the rocks and watched with glaring eyes as he passed. The Unterfeldwebel brought Greg through a maze of rooms and splintered wreckage. Around each corner were more Kraut soldiers clutching Schmeissers or manning mortar positions. Every time he walked past, the Krauts would whisper to each other and point. Greg had to hand it to Sobel. Every detail was there. It gave him a strong sense of being an outsider in an enemy stronghold. Greg was led down into the same cellar where he'd first encountered Barner in the Monte Cassino map. They walked between the wine casks toward the doorway in the opposite wall. Torches lit their way, flickering against the darkness under the influence of a digital breeze. Greg glanced around. There was no sign of the fire damage from the earlier game. They headed into the dark passage that led to the round tower base. The ray of sunlight still shined there, illuminating the wall where the encrypted message once was, but now it was carved with 29.3935-95.3933. Greg turned his avatar to face the familiar metal screen through which he'd spoken to Borner before. It was dark behind the screen. Suddenly, the space beyond filled with the flare of a match. And Borner was there, lighting his cigarette at the end of that damned filter. He cupped it with his hand until it lit, then breathed out a cloud of volumetric smoke. The Unterfeldwebel gave a sharp salute with a click of his boot heels and scurried out, leaving Greg's avatar alone with Borner. Borner looked up and fixed his monocle over his left eye.
We meet again, mein Freund.
Borner clamped the cigarette holder in one corner of his mouth.
You know the console, yes? Use it to answer my questions.
Borner waited for some response. The console. Greg usually used it for cheat codes. He peered at the keyboard and hit the tilde key. A DOS-like console appeared in the northern third of the screen. It listed a number of scripting events that had already taken place, such as the appearance of the Borner model and the creation of the objects in this room. The console served as both a comprehensive log of program events and a command console for overriding game settings. Basically, it gave him a blinking cursor where he could type input. As soon as the console appeared, Borner said,
"Excellent. You have some knowledge to find me again. We will see how much knowledge you have. Have you come alone, yes or no?"
Greg sucked in a breath. He didn't want to admit he was alone, but lying made him more nervous. He typed "yes" at the console line and hit enter. Borner's avatar kneeled down so he could see Greg's avatar around the console window. He smiled at him.
"Good. Have you told anyone else about this?"
Greg hesitated again. What better way to get killed than to say yes? He remembered all too well the video images of body bags from Sobel's estate. But what would that gain Sobel? Why go through so much effort just to kill someone? Greg typed no and hit enter. Borner regarded Greg's avatar, then suddenly thrust open the gate that separated them. The metal door slammed against the stone wall as Borner strode forward to get right in Greg's face.
"I will later find out the truth. Better to admit it now if you have told others."
Borner's eyes bored into Greg through the laptop screen.
"Have you told anyone?"
Greg typed no again and hit enter. Borner smiled that wicked smile of his again. He patted Greg's avatar on the shoulder.
"Ausgezeichnet. Und have you brought your bag of tricks mit you, yes?
Borner waited for an answer. Greg typed yes and hit enter. Borner swept his arms into the air.
Open the gate!
His words echoed in the cellar corridors. Beyond Greg's laptop screen, in the real world of autumn cold, Greg heard a metallic noise. He glanced up toward the front of the car. Suddenly, the thick metal chain blocking the road dropped completely to the ground. The no trespassing sign clattered noisily on gravel.
Fuck me, that's it!
Greg pushed the laptop away and fumbled for the car's ignition switch. He started the car, threw it in reverse, and twisted in his seat to see where he was going. What he saw behind him stopped him cold. Another thick chain had risen up not far behind his car. He could see it illuminated in his backup lights, along with the back of a metal sign, probably identical to the other one. In gravel and without a running start, there was no way he was getting through that thing. He started to panic. He glanced to the left and the right. The birch trees on the left were impenetrable by car. To the right, he'd never get the car over that ditch. He heard talking and looked down at the laptop still facing him on the bench seat. Borner puffed on his cigarette there.
Relax, mein Freund. If I wanted to kill you, I could have done so already. Move your car forward, please.
Greg's mind raced, gauging his chances of fleeing on foot through the birch trees and into the fields beyond. That was crazy, right? He was out in the middle of fucking nowhere. This whole area could be filled with traps for all Greg knew. How much planning had Sobel already displayed? It had to be Sobel. Greg contemplated facing a real-world Borner, and it dawned on him that running away on foot was a one-way ticket to zero health without respawning. Borner stared at him from the nearby laptop. Greg cleared his head of that thought. Borner wasn't staring at anybody. It was just a bunch of texture maps arranged for a first-person viewer. Sobel was fucking with his mind. This was definitely not a cool situation. Borner shook his finger at Greg.
You mustn't be afraid, mein Freund. Unless, of course, you lack skill.
Greg gave Borner the finger and pulled out his cell phone. He took a moment to consider whom he might call. Surely not the police. Definitely not the police. How about one of his road racing buddies, or one of his rave bouncers? Bad idea. Right now, Loki was supposed to be dead. But they didn't know him as Loki. His world was so full of lies, he couldn't keep them straight. Greg cycled through his saved phone numbers and selected his lead rave bouncer. Greg put the phone to his ear. Nothing but static came back. He looked at the bar count. No service. Borner was talking again. Greg looked down.
Your phone is useless. Only Wi-Fi will work here.
His expression grew decidedly less friendly.
Move the car forward.
Greg put his phone away. He shifted the car from reverse back to drive. He took a deep breath, then took his foot off the brake. The tempo rolled forward. Greg realized someone might see his headlights from the road, so he kicked them on. Then he flicked on his high beams. Up ahead, an exterior light kicked on at the cinder block building. Borner growled.
Drive beneath the light.
As Greg's car rolled forward, he crossed the tree line and was suddenly in a well-lit, muddy clearing in front of the cinder block building. There was another vehicle there, a badly smashed VW Vanagon with Louisiana plates. As Greg's Ford Tempo rolled into the clearing, he felt the tires bogged down in deep mud. In a second, he was up to his axles in it and stuck like a fly on flypaper.
Oh, fuck, Greg groaned. Fuck, fuck, fuck.
He pounded the steering wheel. What had he gotten himself into? He should run. Borner spoke again.
Mein Freund.
Greg looked down at the laptop. Borner took another puff on his cigarette.
This is fun, ja?
Borner paused a moment.
Is this you, mein Freund?
The console window populated with Brian Gregg's full name, social security number, age, birth date, last known address, mother's maiden name, a huge piece of his life. The adrenaline of pure, high-octane fear swept through Greg. He almost screamed in terror. He honestly could not remember a time when he'd been more afraid.
This machine knew who he was. It knew his real fucking name.
Borner barked angrily.
Is this you? Answer.
Greg fearfully typed no in the console window beneath his personal information and hit enter. Borner loomed again.
If this is not you, I have other names. But if you lie to me, I will find out. And there will be no mercy. Answer again. Is this you?
Greg pondered Borner's cold eyes, then typed yes and hit enter. Borner relented and went back to smoking.
Good. Now we may begin.
He put one hand behind his back and started pacing.
Run your Wi-Fi scanner again. You will see a new network. You must gain entry to it. Do not attempt to leave here before you do. Auf Wiedersehen.
Borner swept out of the room. The moment he did, the 3D iron grate snapped shut behind him. Immediately after that, the game shut down without warning, leaving Greg staring at his computer desktop. Greg rubbed his forehead. This was a nightmare. At least he wished it was, but since it wasn't, he'd better get down to business. Borner wanted to see what Greg was made of? Okay. Greg launched NetStumbler again. The SSID for the Houston Monte Casino server was now gone. In its place was a new Wi-Fi access point with no SSID at all. No doubt this one was going to be tougher. Greg opened the NetStumbler logs and checked each entry. The new AP was running Wi-Fi Protected Access, WPA, a form of wireless encryption. Damn. He was hoping it would be WEP encrypted. That would take only seconds to defeat. WPA had no structural flaws. It was as strong as its passphrase. But that would be the test then, wouldn't it? Hopefully the phrase wasn't more than 8 or 9 characters. Greg would need to sniff the key exchange messages between the adapter and the access point, then crack the key offline with a PSK dictionary, which he had on his laptop. He could use AirJack to force the key exchange by broadcasting a disassociate message. Greg slumped in his seat. Hopefully there would be some client exchanges to monitor, but if this was a test, then that was the only correct answer. So fuck Borner. It was going to take some time to crack the key, though. Greg pulled out the DC to AC adapter and plugged it into his car lighter, then plugged his laptop into the new AC power source. He launched Asleep, a program for grabbing and cracking wireless key exchanges. He could see the network clearly enough. He sent the command to deauthenticate every user on the new network and prayed to the freaking gods that some client connections were present. 30 seconds later, 2 authentication exchanges occurred to reconnect the clients. Greg started breathing again. He now had an encrypted hash that Asleep was working the dictionary to decrypt. He was on his way. Greg leaned his driver's seat back and stared at the ceiling, wondering if he'd ever get out of here alive.
Chapter 17. Succubus.
John Ross hopped out at the front entrance to Alcyon Insurance. He opened the rear passenger door of Seebeck's Dodge Durango and grabbed his laptop bag from the back seat. It was Seebeck's personal car and reeked of his aftershave. The interior was immaculate, devoid of personal touches like Kleenex holders or errant CDs. It had the brutal cleanliness of a military barracks, and by revealing nothing about Seebeck, it revealed a lot. Ross looked from the back seat into the rearview mirror to make eye contact with Seebeck.
Well, Pete, again, my condolences on Deputy Larson, and I wish you the best of luck on the case.
Seebeck just stared at him.
What's that supposed to mean?
Seebeck's cell phone started ringing. Ross slung his laptop bag over his shoulder.
It means that I'm done. The feds have this under control.
Don't even try that bullshit on me, John. Go get some sleep.
He motioned for Ross to get out, and he unfolded his phone as he pulled away from the curb. He smiled grimly as he saw Ross flip him off in the rearview mirror. Then he answered the phone.
Seebeck.
A woman's voice.
Nothing can kill you, can it, Pete? He felt his pulse accelerate. It was her. When had he last heard her voice? How long ago? This phone line is tapped. Cheryl, I'm heading to the office. Call me there.
The line went dead. Seebeck stowed his phone, then drove a couple of blocks. He pulled over in a residential area, then looked in the rearview mirror. No one watching. He got out and opened the tailgate of the Durango. Seebeck reached down into the spare tire well and came up with a bright red prepaid disposable cell phone. He closed the tailgate, looked around again, then got back in the Durango and plugged the phone into his car lighter. Moments later, the little phone chirped and he grabbed it.
God, it's great to hear your voice. Things have been crazy. We lost 2 men today. I've got more in the hospital.
I know. I caught the news in the terminal at O'Hare.
You're in Chicago?
He knew better than to ask too much.
No, Westwood.
At the company suite?
You'll come meet me.
Oh, God, baby, Seebeck sighed. This is a really bad time. This demon thing is...
You survived, Pete. I'll make you remember why you want to be alive.
That she would. Seebeck was quiet for a moment. Cheryl Lanthrop was the most beautiful woman he had ever been with. Her predatory sexuality made it even harder to resist. It was unfair that he should even be expected to resist a woman like her. He had convinced himself that even his wife would understand. Still, it was a bad time to disappear. But they could reach him by phone, couldn't they? The feds would probably be busy tearing apart Cyberstorm's network all night. And Sobel's estate? Hell, there were hundreds of police surrounding it. If he got caught, no man alive would think less of him. He hesitated. He couldn't find the words.
Only you know what you want, Pete.
He already knew he was going.
He was someone else entirely with her. His responsibilities faded away. His goals were here and now. The conquest of her.
And that's what it required. Conquest.
I'm on my way.
Wilshire Boulevard between Beverly Hills and Westwood Village was a canyon of tony high-rises one row deep. The building seemed out of place in Los Angeles, as though someone had grafted a piece of Manhattan's Upper East Side to L.A.'s suburban grid. This was the location of Cheryl's corporate condo. Cheryl was some sort of medical executive. In one of his fits of curiosity about her, Seebeck ran a background check. She had a surprisingly benign past. Good pre-med education, clean credit, no criminal record. Her employer sold and installed complex medical diagnostic systems, and she traveled the world consulting on multi-million dollar deals. She had money, the type of money Seebeck could only dream about. And she had perks, like the corporate suite at this copper-roofed faux French provincial tower. Seebeck still had a parking card, so he was able to avoid the doorman. His face was still in the news, and he wasn't anxious to be seen in the vicinity. As he exited the elevator on the 15th floor, he peered both ways down the hall to be sure no one was in sight. As he approached Cheryl's door, Seebeck noticed it was slightly open. He looked around warily, then nudged it in. Cheryl stood beneath a halogen spotlight near the entryway. She wore a black cocktail dress with spaghetti straps, black stockings with garters visible below the hemline, wrapped her long legs and shapely shoeless feet. Her auburn hair sparkled in the light. She smirked and curled a finger at him. She was even more beautiful than he remembered, worth losing everything for. Seebeck moved toward her, closing the door behind him. He knew better than to expect consolation from her. What they shared was different. Just before he reached her, she pirouetted and ducked her head low, bringing a roundhouse kick straight at his head. He saw it coming and grabbed her leg just in time. The impact sent him back against the wall. She followed it with an open-hand karate punch toward his face. He ducked back, releasing her leg.
No bruising, Cheryl.
Shh. She put a painted fingernail to his lips. Seebeck took the moment to grab her wrist, twisting her arm around behind her back. He brandished handcuffs seemingly out of thin air. She quickly tried to clear his legs out from under him, but he blocked her legs. Their shins slammed together, and he bore down on her to fling her to the floor. He felt her strong, lean body resisting, and then, finally throwing him over her, he landed hard on the carpeted floor. Struggling for breath, he managed to hiss out, "We've got to be more quiet."
She let out a tigress growl, kicked the handcuffs away, and landed a few vicious punches to his abdomen. His tightened stomach muscles dampened the blows. She smiled playfully and lightly bit his ear. You goddamn pig. She grabbed him in a headlock and started a chokehold. Perfume mixed with sweat filled his nostrils. Adrenaline filled his veins. If this wasn't love, then it was something nearly as good. He felt his consciousness begin to fade. He smacked his open hands against her ears, and she dropped the chokehold in an instant, grabbing her head in pain. He rolled over, kneeling next to her. Baby, did I hurt you? She looked up, one eye and half a mischievous smile visible behind a curtain of auburn hair. He saw his mistake too late, and her open hand shot like a jackhammer into his solar plexus. He doubled over in pain as she leaped over him, moving for the handcuffs. She had a thing for cops, and he was probably one of several she had flings with around the country. He didn't care. She was a sexual hand grenade with the pin pulled out, but he could never manage to resist her. Whatever this said about him didn't matter. Cheryl was here, and the whole world could go screw itself. He heard the clinking of the handcuffs coming up behind him, and he swept one hand back, grabbing her elbow. He shot the other arm up and grabbed her beautiful hair. It was a cheap shot, but effective. He made sure to grab enough of her hair to use as a rope. He twisted it tighter and finally yanked her head down toward his. He felt her struggling, and her open, pouting lips brushed against his. He twisted her arm and pulled her around in front of him. Now she was really struggling, but he used all his prodigious strength to dominate her. All her skill had not been enough. He had mastered her. He heard her moan softly as he wrenched the handcuffs from her hand. In a moment, he had forced her to her knees and slapped the cuffs over one wrist. She struggled mightily one last time, but he forced her head back down using her hair as a leash. The cuffs went over the second wrist, and he felt her sigh and settle back onto her knees. He came up behind her and smelled her perfumed hair. Her lips brushed against his cheek. Is there a problem, officer? Across Wilshire Boulevard, directly opposite the building, a camera lens in a darkened room reflected the streetlights. The camera clicked and whirred as Seebeck and the woman passionately kissed. Angie Anderson raised her eye from the camera lens. She let an aroused breath escape, as though she had been holding it for a while. She had no idea why the voice felt this was news, but it had already been worth the trip. Chapter 18, Abyss. Wrecked county and federal police vehicles came under the glare of a mercury vapor searchlight. The bomb disposal robot's arm panned to reveal more carnage. 1,000 feet away, a spectator in the control trailer whistled softly at the video image. A murmur went through the assembled agents. Special Agent Ellis Garvey released his hold on the joystick and awaited instructions. The FBI's Critical Incidents Response Group, or CIRG, had taken over operations for the siege of Sobel's estate, but Stephen Trier still had nominal control of strategy. He knew that he had to get this situation under control quickly, or it would be taken from him just as he had taken it from Decker. Trier put a hand on Garvey's shoulder. Bring us up to the mansion's front door. The lawnmower-sized robot turned in place on rubberized treads and started moving across a blood-streaked debris field of plastic car bumpers and shattered glass toward the mansion's front steps. Along the way, the robot passed a crushed and twisted version of itself. It was the robot brought in by Gerner's team the day before. Garvey's camera lingered on the image, ominously symbolic. Trier cleared his throat, and Garvey nudged the joystick again, sending the robot forward. He halted the robot at the base of the mansion's front steps and raised its camera arms, shining the bright lights into the yawning black maw of the doorway. The door was still wedged open. A score of federal agents in the command trailer craned their necks to see the monitors. Trier nodded to Garvey, who took a breath and eased the left joystick forward. The little robot's motors whined as it inched up the stone steps. Before long, it moved warily through the front door and into the foyer where some type of fearsome technology had assaulted Gurner and his team. Washington wanted more information. The robot's camera arm panned the room. Glass from a shattered vase littered the tiled floor, along with vomit and specks of blood. Someone in the back muttered, "Jesus." One of the bomb squad guys leaned in.
"Look for transceivers or sensors on the walls."
Garvey started panning the walls with the camera lights. It looked like a classic Mediterranean, but there was a lot more than paintings and sculpture alcoves along the winding stairs. Near the ceiling, an array of mysterious white plastic sensors lined the walls. Trier called out,
"Guys, what are we looking at?"
A deafening silence filled the darkened trailer. In the glow of the camera monitors, Trier looked for Alan Wyckoff, an FBI senior systems analyst who always seemed to know what he was talking about. Although there were bomb squad agents and a couple of computer forensics experts on hand, this wasn't a bomb, and it wasn't software. It looked like a system.
"Wyckoff, what am I looking at here?"
Wyckoff was just a silhouette in the darkness, except for the lenses of his round glasses, which reflected the monitor images.
"Those are standard motion detectors, also what looks to be infrared sensors.
I have no idea what that is. The round pod might be a transmitter of some sort." He turned toward Trier, and the monitor reflections disappeared from his glasses.
"Sir, we're going to need to analyze this video. There's a lot of technology there I'm not familiar with."
Trier looked around at the assembled experts, who were silently nodding in the dark.
"So no one can tell me how the bomb disposal team was incapacitated? No guesses?"
The agents exchanged glances in the shadows. Garvey ventured,
"Should I keep going?"
Trier nodded.
"Get us into the server room."
Garvey took another breath and eased the joystick forward again. The robot moved easily across the floor toward the center doorway at the back of the foyer. The mercury light revealed a long hall with stone tile flooring and embroidered rugs. Mission-style furniture braced the walls here and there along the length of the hall. One of Garvey's team spoke from the console nearby while examining blueprints.
"We want to take the next hall on the right, then it's the second door on the right."
"Got it. Turning."
Garvey turned the robot in place and shined the camera lights down a short side hall. It led into the recreation room toward the back of the house. Garvey panned the hallway, examining the walls and ceilings. More of the mysterious sensors lined the walls. It was dark, except for the lights on the robot.
"Cellar door, second on the right. It should lead down to the server room."
Garvey brought the robot forward, then moved to a second set of controls to activate the robot's arm. The mechanical hand slid into camera view and swiveled once to align with the levered door handle on the cellar door. The arm moved forward, grabbed the door handle, then depressed it. Suddenly, the camera image jolted wildly and shouts of alarm filled the trailer. In a moment, all the screens were filled with snow.
Trier pushed forward. "What just happened?"
Garvey's hands hovered over the useless controls, his mouth open in shock. He turned.
I don't know. Do we have any signal from the robot?"
Garvey and his assistant checked the console and shook their heads. Everyone was talking again.
Trier shouted, "Quiet down! Everybody shut up!"
He turned to Garvey again.
"Play back the video in slow motion."
Garvey nodded, then rewound the video. All the monitors flickered, then a still image came up again, the mansion's side hall.
"Roll it forward slowly."
On screen, frame by frame, the robotic arm grabbed the doorknob and turned.
"There."
Garvey stopped the image. There was an unmistakable gap in the floor toward the bottom of the frame. The floor looked like it was opening up.
"Okay, advance it slowly."
Garvey hit a button. The gap expanded. In a quick succession of frames, the doorknob pulled from the robot's grip, and the entire machine slid down a chute that opened beneath it. Its mercury lights illuminated the dark hole, revealing a cinder block-lined pit, the bottom of which was filled with water. Successive video images showed the water washing up onto its cameras and the robot shorting out. The entire process took about 1.5 seconds. Sidebar conversations filled the trailer. Trier clasped a hand on Garvey's shoulder.
"It's all right.
That's why we have robots. Trier looked unruffled, almost serene. He turned to the assembled agents. I think we've established that there's no power in the house. He pointed to some techs sitting at a frequency scanning console. And there's no radio transmissions emanating from the house, correct? The techs nodded. Trier continued. What we're looking at here is a simple pit trap. Sobel's high-tech weaponry is down. He's gone medieval on us. That's great news. Garvey turned from the robot command console. That's our last robot. We'll have to send back to L.A. for another one. Trier nodded. Bring in several. Fly them in if you have to, but we need to get our hands on Sobel's personal computers as soon as possible. There was silence for a moment in the trailer. Garvey hesitated, then asked, Meaning that we send in the hostage rescue team. Have them go in as far as the pit. I want the area around the cellar entrance ramped over by the time we get the extra robots here. Wyckoff looked surprised.
Sir, are you certain that's a good idea?
Certain? No, not certain. But Sobel's home computers might hold the key to destroying this monster. That's what we came to do, so let's do it. Everyone murmured in agreement. Someone in back asked, What about the Hummer, sir? Pull out the wreckage and ship it down to the L.A. lab. Cover it with a tarpaulin before pulling it out. I don't want to see any more pictures of the death machine on the front page tomorrow. He clapped his hands once. Let's get moving, people. The world's watching. Special Agent Michael Kirchner sat poring over financial documents with five other agents in an unassuming accountant's office in Thousand Oaks. The desks were littered with open folders, receipts, tax returns, and ledgers. Another agent was busy imaging computer hard drives. Kirchner, a CPA and tax attorney, believed that he and his team did more to fight crime than any field office in the Bureau. Organized crime couldn't accomplish much without money. They had spent the last 8 hours scrutinizing the detailed financial history of Matthew Sobel. It was quite a trail. Sobel was an officer in 37 corporations. He had 3 sole proprietorships, 2 partnerships, 11 LLCs, and a slew of international business corporations, holding companies, and offshore trusts. Tons of financial activity over the last 2 years, with equipment purchases, wire transfers, professional and consulting fees. It was a rat's nest. The finances of the rich usually were. Kirchner reviewed a report of the largest capital expenditures. Technical components, from the looks of it. Purchased by one company, but shipped to Sobel's Thousand Oaks address. Kirchner looked up at his partner, Lou Galbraith, sifting through filing cabinets nearby.
Lou, you lost money in fuel cells a few years back, didn't you?
Galbraith stopped, raising his reading glasses up onto his forehead, and gave Kirchner an impatient look.
I don't want to talk about it.
Why? Kirchner held up the printed report.
Sobel made some big purchases that I thought you might be interested in.
He leafed through the report.
Here, identical hydrogen fuel cell power units purchased by 2 separate holding corporations, both shipped to his estate. $146,000 a pop.
Tax dodge?
Kirchner frowned.
We're not trying to nail him on tax evasion, Lou.
He looked down at the report.
Fuel cell power units. Things like that really work?
I wasn't an idiot, Mike. Of course they work. Hospitals and big companies use them to generate electrical power from natural gas. You know, where the electrical grid is unreliable or too expensive. It was supposed to be huge, just before its time, that's all, and...
These things were shipped to Sobel's estate.
Kirchner looked even more concerned.
What's wrong, Mike?
Call the SAC at the Sobel estate. I want to make sure he knows about this.
Agent Roy Tripwire Merritt took a deep breath, gathering in the last of the night air, redolent with moist earth. A sliver of moon hung just above the horizon, silhouetting the tree-dotted hills. He scanned the terrain without night-vision gear, taking joy in this simple pleasure. It reminded him of the Basque region of Spain by moonlight, or South Africa's Transvaal. He'd seen a lot of the world by night, and usually from behind third-generation night-vision goggles. The pre-dawn air was crisp and cool on Merritt's face as he stood in the payload area of an Army 10-ton truck. Its powerful diesel engine labored in low gear as it climbed through a bulldozered breach in the estate wall. The canvas top had been removed, leaving it open to the night sky. Merritt slung an HK MP510 over his shoulder, then looked back toward his FBI hostage rescue team. Six of the best-trained operators in the bureau sat on either side of the cargo bay, swaying in unison as the truck lurched over mounds of dirt and rock. These were his men, and they were intimidating as hell. Clad in black Nomex flight suits, body armor with ceramic trauma plates, Pro-Tech helmets, night vision goggles, and bulletproof face masks, they made Darth Vader look like a Walmart greeter. But of all the missions they had carried out together, from Karachi to the wilds of Montana, Merritt had never had more misgivings than on this one. During the mission briefing, he kept thinking that this was a job for the bomb disposal teams or the demining experts. It kept coming back to urgency. Six officers were dead, nine more injured. No one had any answers, and time was apparently of the essence. Still. Merritt looked down at the metal and wood scaffolding materials lying on the floor space between the benches. Four toolboxes lay there as well. His highly trained rapid response team was going to bridge a pit in a hostile environment. He wondered what sort of fuck-up happened upstairs to make this come about. Merritt glanced over at the mansion 300 yards away. No lights had appeared in it since last evening. Radio communications had been back up for the last hour, ever since the ultra-wideband transmissions from the house died. Merritt spoke normally, knowing his headset mic would pick it up. Echo 1 to TOC. We're at yellow. Request compromise authority and permission to move to green.
Copy, Echo 1. I have your team at yellow. You have compromise authority and permission to move to green.
Copy that, TOC.
Merritt gave his men the thumbs-up signal. They returned it. Wackauer, the breaching specialist, flipped up his face mask and grinned.
Hey, Trip! Why do we need guns? Sobel's already dead.
Cut the chatter, Wack. Dead or not, Sobel managed to kill some good people here. Stay alert.
Wackauer shrugged, then nodded sharply, causing his face mask to flip back down. Merritt stood and looked over the cab of the truck as it advanced slowly across the wide lawn of the estate. They were coming up on the burnt-out hulk of the automated Hummer now. The other men stood to lean against the railing as the Hummer came up on the right-hand side. The truck slowed, then stopped about 20 feet from the wreckage. Two county SWAT team members were in the truck cab. The passenger kicked on a side-mounted searchlight, focusing it on the still smoldering remains. The Hummer was definitely non-operational. The wheels were just blackened hubs, and the interior was gutted.
"Those Marines ever hear of a little thing called evidence?"
Merritt could practically hear Wackauer grinning behind his mask. Merritt ignored him. He spoke into his headset.
Echo 1 to TOC. The Hummer is non-operational. Proceeding to green. Out.
Merritt pounded the cab roof twice. The truck lurched forward toward the mansion some 100 yards away. The truck searchlight swung toward the house. A 3-foot-high terrace wall surrounded the mansion at a distance of about 200 feet. The terrace leveled out the hilltop for the lawns around the pool and patio. The wall prevented the truck from driving all the way to the house, but Merritt agreed with the SAC that driving along the front entrance or rear service road was a bad idea. It was a choke point and could be booby-trapped. Instead, the truck turned in front of the wall, then backed up. The ridiculous beep, beep of the backup warning filled the tense silence. It looked like it was going to work out. The tailgate now stood about 2 feet off the ground as the truck backed up to the terrace wall. It would be easy to unload the scaffolding and tools, but first they needed to scout ahead. Merritt shouted to the driver,
"Cut the engine and the lights!"
Relative silence suddenly prevailed. The sound of crickets returned after a few moments. The only lights visible were the work lamps of the besieging FBI at the estate fence line, about 300 yards away. Merritt swung down his night vision goggles and powered them up. His men did the same. Merritt spoke into his bone mic.
"Leave the scaffolding. Let's make sure we have a clear path to the objective."
Merritt gave a hand signal, and his men fell in line behind him. The plan was to circle around to the front of the house and enter through the open front door. They were on the east side of the house right now, so they were looking at a 150-yard infill over manicured lawns and gardens. Aerial radar had revealed no hidden pits or other apparent traps on the estate grounds to a depth of 10 meters. But the approach to the mansion wasn't what concerned Merritt. He was worried about entering the house itself, especially considering what happened to the last people to do so. Merritt stepped off the truck tailgate and started moving through the night. He felt and heard his men moving close behind him. This wasn't a hostage crisis. A flashbang grenade wasn't going to stun anyone here. Overwhelming firepower wouldn't intimidate the opponent. This was a new situation. Merritt turned and put a hand up to halt his men. "Wait here. I'm going to scout ahead. If you lose contact with me, pull back to the estate perimeter. Understood?" They exchanged concerned looks. This went against everything they'd trained for. They were a team. Even Wackauer had no wisecracks. "That's an order. Assume a defensive posture and wait here." Merritt turned and moved cautiously toward the house. Hundreds of yards away at the FBI command and control trailer, the SAC, Stephen Trier, stood gazing through a FLIR telescope at the distant figures of the HRT unit. He could see one moving ahead of the others, moving toward the side of Sobel's mansion. Trier muttered to himself, "What's he doing?" One of the agents from the command trailer emerged and called to Trier.
"Sir, Special Agent Kirchner on the line for you. Something about Sobel's purchase records."
Trier didn't look up from the night vision scope.
"Kirchner's heading the audit team?"
"I believe so, sir."
"Tell him I'll call him back. He says it's important."
Another command center agent pushed his head out through the doorway.
"Sir, I'm picking up noise from the parabolic mics. Noise from inside the house."
Everyone stopped and looked at the guy with something resembling terror. Trier started walking toward him.
"What kind of noise?"
"It sounds like a pump motor, sir."
"Get those men out of there!"
About 60 feet ahead of his men, Merritt heard the click and stopped cold. His men did likewise. They'd all heard it too, and they instinctively spun to face every direction, training their weapons. Against what? They didn't know. Suddenly, Merritt's radio crackled. Someone shouted in an urgent voice over the channel.
"Echo One, abort immediately! Repeat, abort immediately!"
Before he could react, Merritt heard a disquieting hiss start to emanate from the ground. Just as suddenly, the air around him sprang to life, and he and his men nearly jumped out of their skins. Retractable lawn sprinklers popped up and started spraying the lush terrace lawn with cold water. His team burst out laughing as they stood getting soaked by the lawn sprinklers. Wackauer shielded his night vision goggles and shouted the distance to Merritt.
"Shit, Trip! I just aged 10 years!
Even Merritt smiled back behind his mask this time.
"You heard him. Pull out."
Then something changed. Suddenly, Merritt was aware of an overpowering odor. His eyes narrowed behind his goggles. The sprinklers were no longer spraying water. He looked to his men and shouted,
"Gasoline!"
Before they could turn and run, a high-precision motor whirred in the distant cupola tower. A deep shoom sound issued from it, and the last thing Merritt saw through his goggles was a blinding green flare arcing over the distance between him and the tower. The rolling fireball lit up the sky for a mile around. Its dull roar echoed off the side of the trailer, and the orange light illuminated 300 horrified faces. Trier still held the radio in his hand. He stood paralyzed as shrieks of agony came over the radio channel. All around him, men raced into action, or anarchy. It was hard to tell.
"Get the fire trucks over there! Ambulance! Bring up an ambulance! We've got agents down!"
The fireball climbed to the sky, and in its stark light, Trier could see the lawn sprinklers surrounding it still running. They were spraying water to contain the fire in the precise spot where the HRT unit had infiltrated. Trier felt like he was watching something on TV. It had the surreal feeling of the impossible. People were grabbing him, shouting at him. He couldn't take his eyes off the raging fire, and the wildly thrashing dark forms dancing in the flames like damned souls, then falling. The 10-ton truck was burning like a Texas A&M bonfire. Someone shouted in his ear about radio transmissions, and Trier absently looked down at the radio in his hand. Only static hissed out of it now. That's when it happened. Suddenly, all the lights went on in Sobel's mansion, glowing with a frightful intensity. The lights kicked back on all across the estate. An audible groan ran through the ranks of the besieging agents. Trier snapped out of it and shoved the now useless radio into another agent's hands.
Get to cover! Everybody, get to cover!
The pain, because it must have been pain, was white noise that Merritt had no time for. On the imaginary control board in his mind, every light was flashing red. He ran as only men on fire can run, yanking his Nomex balaclava up to cover his mouth. The whole world had turned into the surface of the sun. He resisted the panic-stricken need to breathe the superheated air. To breathe was to die. But then it turned dark again. The bright glow beyond his clenched eyelids had gone away. Had the night vision goggles failed? Probably. But he'd have to open his eyes to find out, and he wasn't ready for that. But the heat was gone, and now there was only cold. His entire body tingled. It was almost pleasant. Experience told him that, in combat, tingling sensations meant you had just been seriously injured. Merritt staggered on blindly. Finally, he stopped and tore off his night vision goggles and opened his eyes. Instantly, he was blinded by cold water spraying into his face. It felt wonderful. He smelled a combination of gasoline, burned flesh, melted plastic, and hot metal. He turned in place dizzily, feeling shock creep up on him. He stood in a manicured section of lawn right next to a rising mushroom of orange flame 50 feet tall. The cold water spraying over him made it tolerable to be this close. His men were in those flames somewhere. He reached for his bone mic, melted against his cheek.
Wackauer, Reese, Littleton, report! Kirkson, Engels, report!
The microphone pulled off in his hands. His earphones were dead under his Kevlar helmet. His men were gone. All gone. Merritt was numb. He spun in place to orient himself and saw the mansion blazing white light 100 feet further on. He held his arm up and saw that the stock of his MP5 had melted onto the back of his sleeve. His nylon web belt containing ammunition clips had melted into his jumpsuit and Kevlar body armor. He wasn't sure whether he was badly injured, but his temper was beginning to flare. He decided to go with it. Merritt grabbed the gun's barrel with his left hand and wrenched the twisted mass free from his arm. The Nomex appeared to have protected him from the worst of it, but he felt the confused buzzing in his nerve endings that was the neurological equivalent of, "Please stand by for pain." Merritt started running, not toward the perimeter wall and safety, but toward the mansion. He raced for the fenced-in pool area and a set of white French doors with polished brass handles, its windows blazing light. His eyes never left it as he leapt over stone benches and herb gardens. Around him, in the sprinkler wash, he smelled gasoline again, and he heard the whoosh of flames racing to overtake him. But he outran it and stayed in the cool, clear water that served as a buffer against the flames reaching the house. As he ran, Merritt clutched at his back for the sawed-off shotgun strapped there. He was still tugging on its rubberized pistol grip, trying to free it from the melted mass of his web belt when he kicked in the wooden pool gate. Metal gate hardware clattered across the paving stones, but he was already smashing through a field of teak wood patio chairs and flipping tables in his quest for the French doors. Almost there. He was vaguely aware of spotlights focusing on him from the house, but he didn't give a damn what Sobel was up to. He might drop dead once he got there, but he was getting inside that house. He whipped out his Mark V knife and slashed the melted bits of the web belt from the shotgun. To save time, he hurled the knife ahead where it stuck quivering in the doorframe. He drew the Remington 870 shotgun into his gloved hands and chambered around with a satisfying click-clack. Merritt hit the door hard with his booted foot and damn near shattered his shin bone. His forward momentum sent him hurtling into the door, where his knee came up into his mouth, driving a sharp nail of pain straight to the center of his skull. He staggered back and reflexively wiped the back of his glove across his mouth. It came back covered with blood. His front teeth felt loose. Doesn't matter. Merritt leveled the shotgun at the door handles and blasted a foot-wide hole in their place. He chambered another breaching round and quickly blasted similar holes at the top and bottom where the doors met, the most likely spot for reinforcing bolts. Hundreds of yards away, the FBI camp was pandemonium. Agents and police scrambled to gather rescue gear, while others scrambled to order no one to go anywhere near the site of the attack. It was a disorganized mess. Somewhere in the chaos, Trier heard distant shotgun blasts. He shouted, "Who's shooting? Decker, order them to cease fire!"
"Calm is down."
Merritt rammed his shoulder into the French doors, bashing them in. He stumbled into a neo-mission-style entertainment room with wide plank wooden floors. There was a sunken area of sectional sofas in front of a large plasma screen television. The lights here blazed brilliantly, practically blinding him. Nonetheless, he craned his neck and weaved from side to side. He knew what he had to do. The bomb disposal team was taken out by weaponized acoustics, and he wasn't going to let that happen to him. Merritt raised his shotgun and noticed half a dozen different sensors spaced along the ceiling over each wall, behind the brilliant lights. A clear and commanding voice called from the doorway leading further into the house.
"You don't belong here."
Merritt's response came out reflexively. "Fuck you, Sobel." Merritt heard footsteps approaching him over the wooden floor. It was uncanny. There was definitely the sense that someone was there. A change in the echoes of the room. That's when Merritt felt, as much as heard, the deepest sound he'd ever experienced pass over and through him. The nearby coffee table started vibrating so badly that the glass panels fell out of it. Merritt twisted to look back up at the ceiling and noticed a reflected LED light pulsating on the back of one of the round sensor pods. He raised the shotgun just as an ungodly feeling of horror gripped him. His intestines were trying to strangle him, and he felt his eyes preparing to explode. He screamed in agony and fired the shotgun. Immediately, the pain stopped. Merritt paused for a second to lean over and vomit on the floor, but he was immediately back up. His eyes and nose were bleeding, but he wiped it away and swiveled around to blast another Hatton round into an identical sensor on the far wall, then the interior wall. He swayed as he pulled more shotgun shells from his cargo pants pockets and started reloading the Remington. Blood dripped onto his fingers from his nose.
"You son of a bitch! I'm going to shut you down, Sobel!"
Merritt slid a shell into the magazine.
"You hear me?"
His words echoed in the big house. A voice right behind him said,
"There's no need to shout. I can hear you."
Merritt jumped and turned around, letting loose a shotgun blast into the wall behind him. The voice was still there, just inches from his face.
"I see you got past the firewall."
How the hell was this possible? The sound was appearing in midair. No stereo could possibly do that. Merritt scanned the arrays of sensors again, but none were visibly active. The voice was right in his ear, whispering,
"They knew you would die, but they sent you anyway."
Merritt jumped away, twisting a gloved finger in his ear as though an insect had flown into it. "Son of a—" Merritt let the shotgun hang from its shoulder strap while he drew one of his twin P-1445 pistols. The voice continued in his ear, but there was no pain, no agonizing constriction of his intestines.
"They're willing to sacrifice you to find out what I'm capable of."
"Keep talking, asshole."
Merritt stood in formal range stance, aiming at the ceiling sensors. He started shooting them out, one by one, waiting a second after each shot.
"Did they even tell you?"
The fourth shot cut him off. A reflective white plastic panel shattered as the bullet hit it. The voice was gone. Merritt shot out another identical sensor on the far wall, then flipped the safety on the pistol, holstering it. Blah, blah, blah. Merritt noticed his reflection in a mirror over the mantel as he walked further into the room. His whole face was crimson red and covered in blisters, with the headset melted onto his cheek. His Pro-Tec helmet had protected his scalp, but the whites of his eyes were shockingly blood red, and blood trailed down from his nose over his burned chin. The Nomex hood and suit had kept him alive, but he might soon be entering cataleptic shock. The dizziness came at him in waves. He felt the rage building in him again. His men had had much worse. Merritt heard a slight tick sound and a sizzle of static electricity. He spun around to see the plasma screen television come to life. A 3D graphic of the mansion as seen from the air resolved on screen. It looked like a briefing schematic.
You're here for the server room. It's down the hall, to the left, and to the left again. I'm sure they gave you a map, but in case it burned up, here are directions.
The 3D graphic leaped into action, with the camera performing a virtual fly-through, coming down on the mansion from above, straight through the doors Merritt entered by. The camera flew down the adjoining hall, banked left, then sailed through the billiard room, left, and up to the cellar door, which flung open as the camera went down into the blackness. It was like a first-person video game. Merritt grabbed an end table nearby, clearing off the lamp standing on it. Sobel's voice continued, oblivious.
Did you want me to replay that, yes or no?
The face of the plasma screen television shattered under the impact of the heavy end table, and the entire thing keeled over backwards on its stand, sending up a puff of electrical smoke as it died hitting the floor.
No more mind games.
Merritt strode past it and grabbed a piece of the sectional sofa, pulling it up with great effort from the sunken area onto the main floor level. He shouldered it in front of him as he advanced toward the doorway leading further into the house. He held the shotgun in his free hand. The dimensions of Sobel's house went beyond anything Merritt would consider a home. To him, it felt more like a university building. He guessed these were 12 to 16-foot ceilings, and the doors and adjoining hallways were all 2 or 3 times wider and taller than necessary. The hall adjoining the entertainment area was easily 10 feet wide, with terracotta tile flooring in 2-foot squares. The hall could pass as a serviceable elevator lobby for the Biltmore. It ran along the center of the house and was braced here and there with gargantuan furniture. Angry-looking armoires and iron-studded cabinets, done in something akin to Spanish Inquisition style. They looked large enough to serve as a redoubt in the event of Indian attack. As he stood at the entrance to the wide hallway, Merritt leaned right and left to glimpse a little of what lay ahead. He couldn't see into any of the doorways. He pushed the sofa section onward, down the left side of the hall. The sofa's metal-studded feet scraped the tile like nails on a chalkboard. Suddenly, the floor dropped away beneath the sofa section, and Merritt caught himself just before pitching forward into the yawning blackness below the trapdoor. The sofa splashed into a water-filled pit, and then the floor section snapped up, almost hitting Merritt in the face. He heard a latch click, locking the floor in place. It was obviously meant to prevent escape from the pit once a victim fell in. Merritt pounded the trapdoor with the butt of his shotgun. The floor seemed firm. He didn't want to take any chances, so he backed up to get a running start. He sprinted and leaped over the furthest seam of the trapdoor. Landing in a tumble, he purposely shortened by rolling hard into an armoire the size and height of a squatter's shack. In a moment, he was up and ready with a shotgun. He felt the humming sound of the acoustic weapons powering up. He glanced right and left, up near the ceiling, and found the nearest acoustic pod. A blast from the shotgun took it clean off the wall. He found its twin behind him and blasted that as well. He collected his breath in the resulting silence. Suddenly, a voice in front of him said,
"Slap a pair of tits and a ponytail on you, and we've got ourselves a game."
Merritt just